In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the lives and work of two people who have had a very significant impact on the ways that we think about and talk about sex, and they are William Masters and Virginia Johnson. Their research on human sexuality helped set the stage for the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, and their work particularly was important for what they had to say about women and their sexual lives. Now, in addition to being colleagues, the two were also for a time a couple. They seemed, on the surface, in fact, to be an ideal couple, but the reality was rather different, more complicated, perhaps more interesting. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Thomas Mayer about his recent book, Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, The Couple Who Taught America How to Love. It's published by Basic Books, and it is a very, very interesting story. You can head out to the bookstore and find it and take a look. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He's also the author of the critically acclaimed book, Dr. Spock, An American Life, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Also, The Kennedys, America's Emerald Kings. He's an award-winning investigative journalist at Newsday, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's the one to use if it would be a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, your question's welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving along, but of course, you're welcome to call in with your questions and comments. Mr. Mayer, hello.
Hello, David. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. The story, I suppose, starts really with Masters, with William Masters, who was a physician. He was a professor of medicine. He was a gynecologist. He apparently was concerned with the fact that at the time that we're talking about, medical science knew almost nothing about female sexual function. And, you know, one might, the more you learn about him, I guess you might ask some questions about his attitudes towards women. It seems that, in fact, he was really seeking a kind of an information that he thought actually would help patients, information that, as he looked around, found just didn't exist.
Oh, very much so. You know, Bill Masters was a terrific OBGYN. He was a terrific surgeon. He was also a fertility expert, way ahead of his time. He traveled in the circles of people like Dr. John Rock at Harvard, who developed the birth control pill, and people at Johns Hopkins who had also helped Kinsey. But Masters was very aware that medicine was woefully unprepared to deal with the everyday questions about sexuality that their patients would pose. He felt that it was something that medicine should be involved in, that it really was the proper place for the discussion of sexuality. And he was determined to be the one who would help document essentially how the body responded during sex, primarily so that they would understand, medicine would understand, when things went wrong physically, anatomically, physiologically, that doctors would be prepared to come up with remedies for those problems.
Yeah, so he certainly felt people really needed help with sexual issues. At the time that we're talking about, he would have been in medical school, so I guess that would have been the, I don't know, 50s, or maybe it would have been the 19, given his age, would have been the 1940s.
Yes.
What were doctors taught in med school? What were doctors taught about sex?
Not to go near it with a 10-foot pole. That's exactly what they were taught. And in so many words, Masters was warned about it. One of his mentors was a fellow named Dr. George Washington Porter at Johns Hopkins. And he suggested he almost set forth a multi-point criteria for Masters first to achieve. One of the things that he suggested, first of all, that he be married. Secondly, that he be a senior faculty member at an esteemed university. and that he would be practicing OBGYN for at least 10 years. And Masters actually followed that to a T. It was after the publication of Kinsey's book that Masters decided to particularly pursue his avenue of having medicine get involved, not sociology like Kinsey, but medicine get involved. And he was at Washington University in St. Louis, not too far from you folks. And it was there that he was the number two in the department, and he was able to get the cooperation of the chancellor of Washington University, and also surreptitiously the cooperation of the police chief and a number of well-known people in St. Louis, primarily because he was the doctor for so many well-known people's wives in St. Louis. He was kind of the OBGYN for the carriage trade, if you will, in St. Louis. So he was able to convince particularly the police chief to allow him to do this, to conduct a study, which first started with prostitutes, without getting arrested.
Yeah, it's really one of the things that when you get into the story is really remarkable. Well, first of all, that they did it, that they found people who were willing to be subjects to come into the laboratory and engage in various kinds of sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. Nobody apparently had ever done anything like this before.
Oh, no. Yes. There were people that had tried were disciplined or thrown out of medicine within a short period of time. Nobody had tried to do it in an organized, long-term study the way in which Masters hoped to do. However, with the prostitutes that he observed for several months, he would actually go to various different whorehouses around St. Louis and other urban areas, all with the cooperation of the police chief and the vice squad in St. Louis. He was able to observe prostitutes, but what he realized was that their particular peculiarities, having to do with their genitalia, after just the nature of their business, if you will, that it did not lend itself to any type of medical conclusions about sexual response among other everyday, if you will, women. So he was kind of stuck there for a while. In fact, there was a point at which there was a prostitute who was a graduate student. She was apparently doing this to earn extra money. And they were talking about female orgasm. And this prostitute made some reference to faking orgasm. And as Masters often would tell the story later on, he was clueless about what she meant by faking an orgasm. And that's when this particular woman said, "Well, buddy, you really need a female partner. Don't you understand? Women often fake orgasm." So it was kind of a, if you will, an epiphany, a moment of revelation for Masters. And that coupled with the fact that there were problems with the prostitutes as a sample group made him realize that he needed, one, a female partner, and two, that he needed to study everyday women's sexual responses. But he was clueless about how to get that, how to get particularly a female partner. His wife didn't want to do it. All of the female doctors at Washington University, they took a pass. They didn't want to get involved. So enter Virginia Johnson, and that's where she comes into the story.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to that in just a moment. Just very quickly, though, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest, Thomas Mayer. He's the author of a recently published book about the life and times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson. The title of the book is Masters of Sex. It's published by Basic Books. Questions, again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think a number of things really important, I think, about Virginia Johnson. And I think that as you do, and as Masters did, you have to acknowledge her contributions here in many ways. And knowing just how much she did contribute, it's interesting to note how it is she came into this work. As you said, Masters realized, he was told, and he realized, well, he has to have a woman involved here. The other women at the university, they didn't want to have anything to do with this. So here comes Virginia Johnson. She was not a physician. She didn't have any advanced academic training. She came to work with him, I think, initially just because she was going back to school and she was looking for a job. Having said all that, it was really remarkable that she did become such a very important part of the work.
Oh, historically, she was very important. She was really the one, as you pointed out in your introduction, Masters and Johnson's work was, if you had to write a little quick encyclopedia entry about Masters and Johnson, it would be that they pioneered the medicalization, the bringing of medicine into the realm of human sexuality. But they also particularly underlined the power, if you will, of female sexuality. And it was really the influence of Virginia Johnson throughout this work, her desire to get at the truth of sexuality, that was really a big part of the motivation here. She was a remarkable character. In fact, as much as Masters is very, very interesting, he is, in a way, kind of like your average, if you will, medical genius. You know, he's a very hard-driven man who very much lived for his work. Virginia Johnson, in a way, is kind of like every woman in the sense that she was looking for love. She, a big part of her life, in fact, arguably a lot of her whole life, was looking for love. She was the book actually begins in Golden City, which is a small farm town in Missouri, and it talks about she talks about the boy with fiery red hair who took her virginity. But this was the boy that everybody thought she would get married to. The yearbook in Golden City predicted she would get married to him. She wouldn't tell me his name. I later found out from the local historian that his name was Gordon Garrett. And later on, 50 years later, she goes back looking for Gordon Garrett. But she had been in a small farm town. She didn't want to stay in a farm town. She wanted to go to the big city. She first got married to a man twice her age who, as it turns out, didn't want to have children. Her second marriage was to a fellow named George Johnson. And he was the leader of a jazz band in St. Louis, and she was the girl singer. In many ways, Virginia said to me that she always wanted to be a singer at the Metropolitan Opera here in New York. She was always looking for her stage. She didn't find her stage, if you will, in life until she divorced Johnson. By that point, she had two children with Johnson, and she decided to go back to Washington University seeking a degree. In order to pay for the bills, she got a job as a secretary in the medical school. And that's where she came to the attention of Dr. Masters at precisely the time that he was looking for a female, really assistant. What was remarkable about Virginia, almost like a modern-day Pygmalion story, is that she showed almost a native, natural genius for the work. She was terrific at understanding what made people tick. And a lot of her strengths kind of mitigated and accentuated the weaknesses of Masters. Masters was not a strong people person. Virginia was terrific at taking the type of background case studies that were required in putting together their studies. And it was Virginia who ultimately would wind up providing the impetus for the therapy that they came up with, which was the subject of their second major book. Their first book had to do with the physiology of how the body worked during sex. But the second book revolutionized sexual therapy, and it was really very much Virginia's work.
Yeah. And we talked earlier about, you know, perhaps one of the remarkable things about the work is that they got people to come into the laboratory and engage in various kinds of sexual behavior while they were wired up and measured and observed hundreds of people over a decade, mostly women. And apparently it was Virginia Johnson, the one who was responsible for persuading so many of these women. Some of them were women who were graduate students, and some of them were women who were faculty wives. Apparently she was the one who persuaded a lot of these women to be subjects in the laboratory.
Oh, yeah. I was really glad to see that the New York Times reviewed my book over the weekend, and one of the reviewers said that it was written with some degree of good humor. And I was really glad to see that because, there is a certain, if you will, comedy to what they were doing. I mean, it was just kind of crazy in a way. But it was very methodical. It was basically all these various different medical devices, both externally and internally, in the case of women, that were designed to track and monitor and ultimately record and put together the case studies of human orgasm. And it was it was about 700 people over a 10-year period that they studied up on the third floor of Maternity Hospital in St. Louis, usually at night after hours, after 5 o'clock. And they would observe people. I interviewed everybody. Everybody in my book is on the record. I didn't want to use any anonymous sources. I didn't want to use anonymous names or pseudonyms. Everybody is on the record in this book. And I did talk to people who were there, including the photographer. And, it was quite a remarkable thing. It was really Virginia Johnson. She was known as Ginny by everybody in the medical school. That was her nickname. And she was remarkably charismatic. I mean, I could definitely see somebody like a Kate Winslet or somebody, if there was a movie about their life. She was just a remarkably charismatic person who was in an all-male world doing something that was very controversial at that medical school. But she ultimately got a number of faculty wives, nurses, graduate students to all partake in the study, not in a salacious way, but as if they were doing God's work, as if they were, doing something in the name of science. And she was terrific at convincing people in the cafeteria to do this. And it's one of the most funny aspects of the whole book.
Yeah. Something I think, again, we'll talk some more about Masters. And again, I think he it doesn't come off as being the most enlightened, perhaps, in his attitudes toward women or his conduct. I guess, though, one thing to be fair to him that you do say is that he wanted to make sure that she, Ginny Johnson, got credit for her contributions, and I think was sensitive to the fact that he was an MD and credentialed and that she wasn't.
Absolutely. It's a very complicated, very highly charged affair between them, both professionally and personally. And Bill Masters, he was a hard guy on one level. He could be very blunt and very very sure of himself, particularly in groups. He was a very bright guy, but he in a way very much loved Virginia Johnson for making his dream. He was a very driven guy who wanted to achieve this. This was something that he always wanted to do, and it was Virginia. He loved Virginia for making his scientific dream come true. He was stuck. He was going nowhere with it until she came along and really energized the whole thing, made it possible for him. So he always loved her for that. However, there's a lot of other sides to it. There is the side of a man who's married himself. He has two children out in the suburbs. He required, within the first year of working together, made it clear to Virginia that having sex with him would be part of the job. Now, of course, by today's standards, that's certainly, no doubt about it, sexual harassment. And when I spoke to Virginia about it, she kind of was of mixed feelings about it. First of all, very clearly, she said she didn't want to have sex with him, certainly not at that stage in their relationship. And it was clear that if she didn't do that, that she might be replaced. And this was something that she really didn't want to do for financial reasons and such. So, you know, that type of aspect of their relationship, I think Masters is to be rightfully criticized. Hmm. However, at a time in which most doctors wouldn't allow their assistants to have any type of equality in their relationship, he did allow Johnson to be given credit in a way that probably most doctors would never have allowed. So it's a very complicated relationship almost from the very start. It is both a case in which she is helping to make his dreams come true, and in a way he is giving her a great deal of credit publicly. She's making money in a way that she never felt that she could, certainly not, you know, prior to meeting Masters. And it was also, if you will, he provided the stage for Virginia to make her mark in a way that she always wanted to as well.
He, after they had been working together and they had had the sexual relationship, he was married at the time. He asked her, that is, Masters asked Jenny Johnson to marry him when she got a proposal. She got a marriage proposal from somebody else. And he was married, and he actually asked her to marry him and divorced his wife. And so here you really have to ask the question, well, why is that? Now, you know, not only why did she accept and marry him, and why did he decide that he needed to divorce his current wife and to marry her?
Well, you know, this is one of those aspects, as I mentioned before, it's almost hilarious the way in which they have their public image was of such in control, very assured people, but behind the scenes, they had a remarkably complicated soap opera of a life going on between them. What happened was there was a man who was a perfume manufacturer. This company would provide the actual scents in various different perfumes, but also things like the cocoa and cocoa puffs, the lemon and lemon pledge. This guy was a millionaire in New York, and his company provided money to Masters and Johnson because he recognized that this whole aspect of pheromones, in other words, scents related to related to sexuality, the way in which scents and the sense of smell is a big part of human sexuality, that if somehow they could put their finger on the scent of love, if you will, that he could monetize that. He could capitalize on it and make a fortune on it. So he provided some money to Masters and Johnson, and Masters courted him very assiduously. However, this fellow, their patron here, he also developed an affair with Virginia Johnson. And he was married himself, and he decided that he wanted to get married to Virginia. And when Masters got wind of the fact that they were having an affair, he decided that he would break up his marriage and convince Virginia Johnson to marry him instead, so basically so that they would keep their partnership together. By that point, Masters and Johnson's private affair, sexual affair, had somewhat fizzled. It still was somewhat in place, but it was fundamentally, it had fizzled. And they agreed to get married at the height of their fame. They were on the cover of Time magazine. They got married to keep their partnership together in essentially a loveless marriage. And I found that really amazing. Mm.
By this point, this was a business relationship. It was a professional partnership. They had become a brand, in a sense, Masters and Johnson. And I think that maybe they both felt, certainly he felt, that breaking that up would be a very bad thing indeed.
Exactly. He was willing to sacrifice his life. He had been married for 20 years out in the suburbs of Ladue, which is a suburb of St. Louis. He had been married to a lovely woman who happened to be good friends with Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, this was not something that was, this was a much more complicated situation. But in any event, he got, essentially got rid of his wife, Libby, who was this lovely person. In fact, if you remember Gone with the Wind, she's almost like the Olivia de Havilland character. And Virginia, in a way, in many ways, is kind of like the Scarlett O'Hara character. You know, she's much more attractive, more sensuous, charismatic. And this was a woman who everybody said was a master's wife, first wife. Everybody described her as a lovely woman who was just a great mother to her two children and adored Bill Masters and also considered Virginia to be friends. In fact, she would watch Virginia Johnson's two children along with her own children when Masters and Johnson went on the road to talk about their books. Little did she realize, or she probably realized, but just didn't want to confront the fact, was that they were having an affair during this time period.
Well, do you think, you talked about how early on when she, when Jenny Johnson was hired essentially to be an assistant, later became very, very important in the work, but essentially was hired to be an assistant, and fairly early on, Master said to her, well, you know, as part of the deal here, you will have sex with me. She didn't really want to, but felt that she needed the job, so she apparently went along. And then later on, they actually became married and were a married couple for, I think, about 20 years?
Right.
Were married. Was it, and at that point, you, as you described it, it was something of a business relationship. Then I suppose the question is, at some point, did these people love one another ever?
Yes. In a way, I think that they never did stop loving one another, even though they said, both said independently to others that it was a loveless marriage. They had achieved things that a man and a woman professionally had never really achieved before in this country. Very few, couples, maybe in entertainment or whatever. But they had achieved a lot together. So, you know, it's interesting. Even at the end of my book, for 4 years, Virginia Johnson insisted that it was a loveless marriage. And indeed, this is something that Masters later said to other people as well. However, recently I had a conversation with Virginia Johnson about this, and she had read the book, and somewhat to my surprise, she liked the book, you know, because it's a very candid book, and you never know how people are going to respond. And we had a conversation about Bill, and she talked about this lost love of her high school youth, this fellow I mentioned before with the fiery red hair, Gordon Garrett. But then we talked about Masters. And I said, you know, I still get the sense that you still kind of love him. And in a way, she does. She actually acknowledged it, which was kind of interesting because by that point, obviously, I had finished the book. This is a relationship that was highly charged, very complicated. It was kind of, as I mentioned, she helped make him and he made her, you know, in the sense of Masters became more than he ever could have been with only with Johnson's help. And conversely, Johnson achieved the type of status that she would never have been able to get without Masters' involvement in her life. Mm. So they both were very, very product of one another's work.
Bill Masters passed away in 2001. As you say, Jenny Johnson is still alive. She's 84, I believe, and you had the opportunity to meet her and spend some time talking with her. She apparently felt that she was okay with this project because it was an opportunity for her personal story to be told. And indeed, she revealed quite a lot of personal details, including some things about her own sex life to you. These things are included in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that Virginia Johnson was it's funny to read the responses and the reviews about Virginia Johnson's sex life, such as it was, and the response that people have. Some people have said that she was promiscuous, and to some extent that may be true. But, you know, by today's standard, she certainly had, as I understand it, about as many sexual affairs or relationships as most modern day women have, you know, particularly younger women. I think younger women would identify with a Virginia Johnson much more so than perhaps her contemporaries, even to some extent the baby boomer women who kind of came of age and broke a lot of barriers as a group under the, you know, waving the flag of feminism in the 70s and the 80s. I think today's current women, the women of portrayed in Sex and the City, women who decide that their lives, their love lives, are going to be as independent-minded as men have always enjoyed, or at least as men have always had throughout the ages. And I think she was an independent-minded woman. So, it's interesting to see how people view Virginia Johnson. I just think she was kind of ahead of her time. I think I quote somebody in the book saying that one of her contemporaries, a doctor who knew her very well, and I think that's true. I think she was, a pioneer of female sexuality in a personal life, in a professional life, excuse mm-hmm. me. But in her personal life, I think she just kind of was much more of an everyday American woman, independent-minded about her sexuality, more so than most women of her generation would ever let on.
You said that she's read the book and she's pretty much okay with it. I know that you met Bill Masters. You apparently think that if he could read the book, he wouldn't be happy about it.
Oh, no, he would have. he had spent his entire professional career telling people not to talk to the press. There was a lot of curiosity about what they were up to, and there were people that, needless to say, there were presidential candidates, political candidates, Hollywood celebrities. I mentioned some of them in my book by name, but he wanted to make sure that there was a degree of confidentiality and secrecy. And actually, a big part of my effort from a reporting standpoint was geared towards convincing people, almost hand-holding, if you will, convincing people that this would be a serious biography, but that it was important to be on the record, and that I took a lot of time to convince people to speak publicly about their experiences.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Thomas Mayer. He is the author of the recent book Masters of Sex. It is a biography of Masters and Johnson. The subtitle is The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. It's published by Basic Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that they had decided, particularly Masters had decided, that if they really were going to get the information that he wanted, this understanding of what physiologically was happening in people when they had sex, they were going to have to do this in a scientific way. They were going to have to bring in people into the laboratory. They were going to have to apply whatever technology they had. So they were going to have to get people to come and do this. And indeed they did. But when they were doing this actually on the campus of the university there at Washington University in St. Louis, how many people knew what they were doing there, and then how is it that eventually it came to the point where when the university asked them to leave and they went into private practice. I think they actually moved across the street. They went into private practice, and then at that point was really when they became very, very famous.
Oh, yeah. When you think about it, it's hilarious. What they did, Masters, once he got the okay from the university, really pushed the envelope. But of course, if you're a scientist, how are you going to track human sexual response? The same way that for literally generations they did with rabbits, and they observed, they connected people to instruments. There was a contraption that they created that was essentially a dildo with a camera attached to it, and that's how they filmed female orgasm. And that went on for about, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, and maybe maybe about a half a dozen people had actually been aware of it or been observing it. Now, a number of people in the medical school had heard rumors about it, but it was very much hush-hush. And eventually Masters, around 1959, 60, somewhere in that ballpark, might have been 61, but in that time period, he decided on a late Friday afternoon when various doctors would speak about their research, he decided to unveil to the jury of his peers, his medical colleagues at Washington University, exactly what he's been up to. And it was late in the afternoon, they served drinks to the doctors, as they often did. You know, this is at the end of a long week here. And they sat down in the theater, and he started to talk about it. And then he showed a film. And it was a film of several women having orgasm. And it was as if it was suddenly they were at a bachelor's party watching a stag film. Now, Masters was kind of had a tin ear to the politics of this. I guess because he had gotten the approval of the chancellor and also the department chairman, who was a personal friend of his, I think he felt that he was kind of insulated from the politics of it. Well, of course, a lot of doctors were appalled by it. And in fact, some spread the rumor that one of the women up there might indeed be Virginia Johnson herself, which Virginia Johnson and other people, including the photographer, said that that's not true. But it created a whole load of problems. Bear in mind, Masters' work was never funded with any type of government research money. So the school had allowed his surgical fees to be diverted to help finance his research project here. Well, when all of that got out, there was a revolt within the faculty. And eventually, they wound up having Masters and Johnson created a foundation. And they had to move across the street, and that's where they did the rest of their work. That was at a considerable price to them that later, I think, caused some problems for them because they didn't have the type of academic oversight and kind of the academic respectability that having a full-time affiliation with the university brings. Certainly Kinsey had that at Indiana University. Ironically, very interesting, almost bizarrely, frankly, Washington University still to this day has an animus towards Masters and Johnson. I know when I was out in St. Louis recently, we tried to talk about this book on campus, and three different groups said thanks but no thanks. So I eventually went to a local bookstore. Now, I had been at Harvard Medical School. I had been at National Academy of Sciences out in Los Angeles. And it was very odd that Washington University still has this view towards Masters and Johnson's work. But it gives you an idea of the volatility of sex, the way in which organized medicine viewed this at the time, and it says a lot about our society.
Yeah, we have a caller here, someone in Urbana. Let's talk with him. Line one.
Hello.
Hello.
Slightly off topic, but I haven't got to your book yet, but I just finished Mary Roach's book, Bronk, which came out last year and is now in paperback. Are you familiar with that, and what do you think of her book?
Oh, I think she's a very funny writer. She is in the vein of people like Bill Bryson, who often write in the first person, and she's a very humorous, very talented, terrific writer. She, as you may know from reading the book, she has started that book by trying to get an interview with Virginia Johnson about exactly what we're talking about, this sex experiment. What became the biggest sex experiment in U.S. history was the one that was conducted by Masters and Johnson, and Mary Roach tried to speak to her, and Virginia's just rebuffed that offer. But I think Mary Roach is a terrific writer.
Yes, I agree. She's very witty and funny in places. Thanks much. I'll hang up.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. And again, let me introduce our guest, Thomas Mayer. He is the author of the book Masters of Sex. It is about the life and times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson. The book is published by Basic Books. He's also written a book about Dr. Spock. That's Dr. Spock and American Life. That was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Also, he wrote about the Kennedys in his book, The Kennedys, America's Emerald Kings. Questions, welcome. 333 800-223-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the places where she, that is Virginia Johnson, was particularly important was in the kind of therapies, the treatment that they developed to help couples that were sexually dysfunctional. In fact, they coined the term sexually dysfunctional. I think that it's true that that some of these kinds of the kinds of techniques that they develop, people are still using.
Oh, they are. Yes. Before, you know, Masters and Johnson, people would go, sex was in the realm of the local priest, rabbi, and minister, or people would go to a Freudian trained analyst. They came along when Freud was at its height in America. And what they did, instead of spending months, sometimes years, talking about your relationship to your mother and trying to figure out all these various different aspects, they came up with a therapy that took 2 weeks, had an 80% success rate. It usually goes by the name of cognitive behavioral therapy. But basically, in plain English, what they did was they would bring married couples who would have this tragedy, the tragedy of the bedroom, as Tolstoy would call it, that in other words, they were unable to communicate physically their love for one another. These are married couples, often who have been married for years, who had either not consummated their marriage, or there was some type of major problem in the bedroom. And what they did was they were able to counsel people in basically how to wind up learning how to touch one another. First, in a non-sexual way, for the first few days in a non-sexual way. But then eventually their therapy within 2 weeks, as I mentioned, had an 80% success rate in the sense that people wound up consummating and having sexual intercourse within 2 weeks. And that was just an absolute miracle by standards at that time period. And a number of medical institutions around the country adopted these methods. They're still in place today. One of my best friends is a doctor at University of Chicago, but he was trained at Cornell, and he was trained in that by one of the disciples of Masters and Johnson, and it's still very much a part of medical training today.
You know, I keep coming back, I guess, to the idea that getting people just to talk about their sexual activity is tough enough. Just getting people to tell you what they do. The idea of having somebody go into a laboratory and doing it, now here this is something, this is entirely different territory. And, you know, one imagines how would Virginia Johnson, for example, because she apparently was the one who was really good at this. I mean, how would she talk with, say, a woman that she was trying to get to come into the laboratory to use this device that she described to have an orgasm, to do that, to be wired up, to be filmed? How it is you would go about persuading somebody to do that, and then how it is they, in a sense, persuaded themselves or, you know, gave themselves permission to do this?
Well, there's a couple of different factors going on. First, I should make it clear. Their first book dealt with human sexual response, and that was in the laboratory. Mm. Their therapy, though, they never observed people having sex in their therapy. What they did was all talking therapy, and the couples that would arrive at their clinic would do their homework, if you will, in hotel rooms or, you know, someplace locally. They would do it after they had met with the counselors at their clinic. So there was two very different things going on. As for the lab and convincing women to do this, well, you know, I think one of the I cannot stress enough that their work underlined the equality of sex among women as well as men. That, in other words, that many women are interested in sex. That having an adequate and having a meaningful sexual part of their lives is as important to many women as it is for men. And Virginia Johnson was just terrifically able to articulate that. And there were more than plenty of women in the university community who were willing to buy into that. These were primarily younger women in their 20s and their 30s, and they were willing to do it. Also, one other thing about that, some of these couples, and many of them were married couples, some of them were anonymous encounters with silk masks on and such. But many of them were also married couples. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these married couples were also seeking the help of masters in the fertility realm. In fact, when you're having difficulty having children, the whole aspect of sexual intercourse and timing it correctly and what time of the month you're having sexual intercourse in order to conceive a child, that's all part of the regimen that Masters was suggesting to people as part of the fertility. And I think some of those people were also involved in the lab studies as well. So they had a kind of a mishmash of people involved in there, but primarily they were younger people who, and among the women, who were willing and agreed that this was a very important part of human life, yeah. And that this would be a terrific contribution to medicine if this study ultimately was realized.
Yeah.
It was.
You talked about the fact that at sometimes in these sexual encounters, people wore masks, I guess, in a sense, for there to be some privacy all around. Did I remember this right, that it was actually somebody's mother? Was it
yes.
Bill Masters', Masters' mother who made them?
She would sometimes, after hours, after they were finished, would serve Bill and the staff dinner. She lived near the medical school, and so she made silk masks for them. In fact, there's a very humorous scene in which there's a doctor who was a good friend of Masters who was asked to help out on a moment's notice with one of the women, and she pulled off the mask. And he realized this was a girl that he had dated several months earlier. So, it's one of those things. There is kind of a comedy, if you will, to this aspect of it. But bear in mind, this was not only the biggest sex experiment in American history, but fundamentally what it did was it provided a whole new understanding of female sexuality. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind, the way that most doctors viewed a female orgasm was defined by Freud himself, who made a very clear distinction between a vaginal orgasm and a clitoral orgasm. He would say that a clitoral orgasm, which didn't necessarily have to involve a man, could be the result of some type of masturbation by a woman. He felt that was a, quote, immature orgasm. What they showed clinically, definitively, with photographs and with their medical equipment, was that there was no medical distinction between these two types of female orgasms, and in fact that women were capable, unlike men, of multiple orgasms in one sexual encounter. So this was, needless to say, dynamite. Mm-hmm. It was dynamite that even the feminist movement of the 60s and the 70s, if you look at almost every major feminist writing about female sexuality in the last 30 or 40 years, it all touches upon the findings of Masters and Johnson. And even in their book, even though they talked about the equality of the sexes, when you carefully read their first book, Human Sexual Response, you realize that more than two-thirds of the book is devoted to female sexuality, and that in many ways women are much more powerfully sexually than men are.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them in. Robinson is next, line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes?
I was really surprised to hear who he was talking about today, because five of us from Robinson were in the School of Nursing at that time at Barnes Hospital. We had Dr. Masters as one of our professors in obstetrics. And I bought his book right after it was published, and I loaned it to somebody, and I never got it back. I wonder why. I don't know if any of my classmates took part in it. We just had our 50th reunion, so I'd sure like to ask him when we were all together to see if anybody took part in that. But thanks so much for bringing him up again. I have such good memories of him. And his classes.
He was a terrific teacher.
He was.
A lot of people told me what a great teacher he was.
He was.
And he was very supportive of younger staffers.
Yeah.
He was a very complicated guy. He could be on one level hard as nails, And by his own volition, he could be a tough SOB. But on another level, he had a great empathy for his patients.
Yeah.
You know, I talked about in my book about this whole theory of gay conversion that was came up in their third book. And he felt that their treatment could help people, even those who would want to change their sexual orientation. And sometimes he would push things perhaps beyond the pale in that regard. But he always had a great empathy for his patients. He was a terrific doctor at Washington University.
Yes, he was.
And,
I'll never forget him.
With Virginia was just amazing.
Well, I didn't ever meet her. I know he always had a patch on one eye, right?
He had a condition what often is called walled-eyed. He later had it fixed later in life for cosmetic reasons. But he had a very off-putting look there for a while in which his eyes were somewhat askew. So, you know, that type of appearance could be somewhat off-putting to some folks. And that was another reason why Virginia Johnson really helped humanize Bill Masters, particularly with the patients that didn't know Masters the way that you did.
We are going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We have a caller that we can't take, but we're just here at the end of the time. It's a very interesting book. So for anybody who would like to read more of the story, and there's certainly more of the story here, look for the book. It's recently out. It's titled Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, The Couple Who Taught America How to Love. It's published by Basic Books by our guest Thomas Mayer. His last name is spelled M-A-I-E-R. You're going to go and look for the book. And Mr. Mayer, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.